Hi, hello. How are you? Hi, hello. Hi, how are you doing? I'm doing good. Hi, hello, hi. Episode 19. Welcome to Analog Thoughts, episode 19. I am your host, Steven, aka Mount Analog. I don't think that much has transpired since the last time I did a podcast. I've still been biking with Felix, and it's completely surreal to see him develop new skills every day, you know? Constantly learning, growing, looking around, understanding his surroundings, and just like, what is going on? It is wild. He's just a sweet, 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 sweet human boy. He laughs at new things every single day, and he gets excited about new things every single day. It's crazy. On the art side of things, I just made a new, like, logo design thingy, and I'm really proud of it. I plan to throw it on some merch soon. It's kind of like this. Someone described it when I posted it as Mount Analog's moving castle, and I was like, that is a great description. It's like my head with like some smoke and swords and crystals and music notes and like some like technology and all of these like, yeah, just all of these elements, but it has like an illustrative like storybook feel to it. So yeah, I'm going to throw that maybe on some t-shirts really soon. So keep your peepers out for some new merch, new swag, new things. I have a really big show announcement coming very, very, very soon. I can't talk about it yet, but hold on to your hats because as an artist, for me, this show is a really top-tier, like, just experience. I'm honored to be a part of it, and it's really trippy how everything even happened, honestly. So I can't wait to tell you, but keep your ears open for that one. What else is new? I just finished The Fall of Gondolin, which is a J.R.R. Tolkien piece. It happens during the first age of Middle-earth, and it's about the fall of Gondolin, which is an elven city that gets overtaken by... Well, actually, I'm not even going to say. If you haven't... I don't want to ruin it for you. But if you haven't read The Fall of Gondolin and you are a Tolkien fan, highly recommend. There's actually a lot of the book is like Christopher Tolkien recapping notes that J.R.R. Tolkien made about his world, and it's just really interesting to kind of see how the world building, how his universe kind of like was a burden to him. And not that he didn't enjoy it, not that he didn't enjoy like creating the universe that he created, but there were just a lot of obstacles in his way while he was trying to get it published. He already had like all the success of The Hobbit, and everyone was like, this is sick, we want a Hobbit version too. So he wrote the Silmarillion, and then he wrote like all of this other lore and all of this other stuff that was like really dense. Like The Hobbit's a kid's story. It was written for, you know, like children. It's a children's story. And the Silmarillion and the Fall of Gondolin and the Children of Hurin, all of the books that he and the Lord of the Rings, they aren't necessarily kids stories. So like when he went to pitch these things to publishers, they were like, this is not what we had in mind for your next thing. We don't know if we can publish this. And also there were all of these it was after World War I, and there were all of these shortages of just resources, and one of those shortages was paper. So after he finished writing the Lord of the Rings, he had a really hard time getting it published because it's such a big body of work. And I know, like, it's to, you know, we think of it in three sections, even though I think technically it's like 6 or 7 books, but it's 3 sections, The Fellowship, Two Towers, and The Return of the King. He wanted to publish the whole thing as a complete collection. He was like, I don't want to strip this down to 3 pieces. So he's got all these books. He's got The Lord of the Rings. He's got The Silmarillion. He's got The Fall of Gondolin. He's got The Children of Hurin. He's got all the stuff he wants to publish. This universe he's been creating for years, but like I said, this is after World War I. There's a shortage of resources. One of those things is paper, and none of the publishers are able to commit to publishing such a dense body of work. They're like, this is freaking huge. We don't have the paper to print this. So it was really hard for him to get the green light on these things because of World War One, a war that he fought in, a war that he was a part of that was still wreaking havoc. Well, actually, some was because of World War One and World War Two, depending on the work that we're talking about. But either way, these world wars were directly responsible for a lot of the publishing woes that he faced trying to get these things published. And he talks about this in the Fall of Gondolin book. Like, it's a story of the Fall of Gondolin, but it's also, there are a lot of just notes about the publication history of his tales and his books and how hard it was for him to face all the obstacles he had to face. Like, he was broke for so long because he was just writing and just kind of like trying to get this thing published, pitching it to publishers. And he also wanted to move on to other works. He's like, I don't feel like this is as finished as I would like it to be, but it has been such a weight on my life. Like, I need to set it free. And I think that's a really, really applicable sentiment to all artists. Like, you never really finish your thing. You just are like, this has driven me to a point of almost madness, and now I need to abandon it. Not abandon it, but I need to just like let it free. Like, it will never be done. And Tolkien knew that, and he was like, this is as far as I'm taking this. It has been such a huge part of my life. I need to get it out there. I need to get it to people. So it was cool to hear that sentiment echoed even through his works. Because, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you know I'm like a ridiculous super fan of Tolkien stuff. You'll probably hear me do more stories, more of his stories in the future. But anyway, I read The Fall of Gondolin. I'm not going to talk about too much of the story of The Fall of Gondolin because I don't want to spoil anything of that actual story for you. But if you're a Tolkien fan, go and read it. I'm also reading the first book of the Assassin's Apprentice series, which is really good. It's another fantasy. It's another like high fantasy book. I'm also about halfway through this Spider-Man graphic novel, which is Miles Morales Volume 1, straight out of Brooklyn. It's really great. We get some like really classic characters. The Rhino's in it. And he actually shows up and teams up with Spider-Man. He's a good guy. And it's also got Captain America, and there are some new villains, and there are some old villains, and there are some new relationships between heroes and villains. I just really like how Miles Morales has his own thing going on. He has his own unique Spider-Man flavor. Like, he is an iteration of Spider-Man, but he throws his own spin on the situation. He's still snarky, and he still has like corny one-liners, but he's just like, it's different. If you haven't read a lot of new Spider-Man stuff, I highly recommend checking out any of the Miles Morales stories or graphic novels. But enough about me. I feel like that's good on me. I hope all of you have been doing well. I hope you've been having a glorious human experience. I hope that reality has been shining the blessings upon you. I hope that you've been feeling healthy and safe and warm, and I hope you've been showered with kindness in all of the ways that you deserve. Let's get into today's topic. Today we're going to talk about one of the most renowned horror writers of all time. He is a pillar of the horror genre. Someone who was capable of building a visceral and raw atmosphere, and someone who was able to captivate both casual readers and seasoned readers as well. And as someone who fancies himself as a poet and a writer of lyrics and stories, I have, like so many other people, been deeply inspired by poetry and stories by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe just had this way of capturing a tone, an atmosphere, and embedding it into his stories. He was himself a tortured artist and lived to see so many dark and strange things happen in his life. If you listen to my episode about the Brothers Grimm, this episode is going to be very similar to that, where I give a brief overview of the life of Edgar Allan Poe, as I did with the Brothers Grimm, and then I want to talk about, I want to read three of his pieces after I do a just kind of like a gloss over of his life. He was born in 1809 in Boston, Massachusetts, to two American actors. So he kind of had theatrics and a sense of drama in his blood. His father abandoned the family in 1810, and his mother died a year later of tuberculosis. So from an early age, his life was marred with tragedy. And at this point, he goes off and becomes a foster child for the Allen family in Virginia. They never officially adopted him, but this is where the Allen in Edgar Allan Poe comes from. So he moves and gets like pseudo-adopted by the Allens, and then he goes off to college. While he's in college, he's like, I don't have enough money to do this, and he decides to enlist in the army. He actually does very well in the army and becomes somewhat of a name for making artillery shell casings and goes on to study at West Point. But then he decides that West Point is not for him, and he stops showing up for formations and exercises and stuff like that, and he gets discharged. But not before convincing his fellow classmates to help him financially publish a work of poems aptly titled Poems. And at this point, he's been writing and dabbling, and he's getting very small runs of poems and stories published. And he decides that he wants to take up poetry and writing full time. And this was also around the time that his brother died of alcohol-related illnesses. So his dad leaves his family. His mother dies a year after that. He goes and gets kind of adopted by this Allen family. He starts to go to college. He doesn't have enough money to finish college, so he goes to West Point. He does really well at West Point, but then he decides, like, I don't know if this is for me. I am going to actually become a poet. But he picked a really hard time to become a poet and a writer, because the 1830s was a time of economic turmoil in the United States. Decent paying jobs were very scarce. Magazine and publishing companies would publish things that were written in the UK in the United States because at the time there were no international copyright laws, and they could just rip off writers in the UK and publish their stories over here, and they didn't have to pay them anything. And this was happening all the time. But despite all of this, he starts becoming a writer and critic for different magazines. He starts getting poems and short stories published here and there. He eventually wound up landing a job as an editor at a pretty big editorial in Virginia. He was fired after a few weeks for being drunk on the job. So at this point, he returned to Baltimore and decided to marry his very young first cousin, which is super creepy and weird, but apparently this was kind of like par for the course during the 19th century. It wasn't uncommon at all to marry your first cousin, and it wasn't uncommon at all to marry people that were much, much younger than you. People had different standards for morality and obviously legality. And it was a very, very weird time. So after he marries his first cousin, he decides to try and get his old job back, which he is successful in doing. So him and his new wife move back to Virginia, and he begins to get several poems, book reviews, book critiques, and stories published through his position. So he's gaining a little more renown, and he's able to get his novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, published. And it was widely reviewed in 1838. And in the summer of 1839, he became assistant editor of Burton's Gentleman's Magazine, which is like, at the time, was like a really big magazine. And he published numerous articles, stories, reviews, which also led to enhancing his reputation as a critic and a writer. And also in 1839, he was able to get another set of, like a collection of tales published that would add to his renown. Even though it was like a collection of more grotesque stories, it helped start to elevate him even more as a horror writer. So he's building all this renown as a critic, as a poet, and then he puts out this one in 1839 that's like kind of gross and weird, and it's met with mixed reviews, and it got some like bad publicity, but the bad publicity winds up working in his favor. You know, the old saying, any publicity is good publicity. It was kind of like the situation, was kind of like the thing going on in this situation. So now he's working for two publishing outlets. He's gaining clout. He's getting reviews. He's getting a lot of reviews, and he decides he's going to start his own publishing journal. And this idea kind of flops, and it never really gets off the ground. And that's mostly because, like I said before, the economy at this point was really bad. He had this vision of starting his own publishing journal, and it just didn't work because the money wasn't there for it. There weren't enough people that were buying and reading things because they couldn't afford it. It was more of like a luxury to buy a journal of poems or a journal of short stories, so it became really hard for him. So for a few years, he starts just taking jobs at different magazines, and being like a writer or an editor, he's just doing piecework, finding work at publishing companies wherever he can, and actively trying to get his stories published at these companies wherever he can. But he kind of grows tired of this tumultuous piecework, this roller coaster of jobs, and he eventually tries to secure a position working for the president, who the president at the time was John Tyler, and he wanted to work at the U.S. Customs House in Philadelphia because he was like, this is a secure job, I can do this. It's clerical, it's something that, you know, I've done before. I've been writer, editor, worked at all these offices, so let me try and do this. And he actually organized a meeting with one of the friends of the president to talk about the position, but he didn't show up to the meeting, and it's rumored it's because he was drunk, which there's tons of some substantiated, some non-substantiated rumors about Edgar Allan Poe's struggle with alcohol and being an alcoholic, alcoholism, and just like some of it was slander that was published about him or people talking about him because they were haters, and some of it was actually true. So somewhere in the middle is where the truth lies on this one. Flash forward a few years later, one night he and his wife are singing at the piano and a blood vessel breaks in her throat. And she's diagnosed with tuberculosis. And now, this diagnosis really ramps up Poe's drinking. He really starts abusing alcohol because of the stress of her illness and just the stress of like supporting her and him and making things work. And also, she was a big muse for him, and he loved her. You know, it was his wife. She was a muse, and they were partners, and this was kind of like a very dark source of inspiration for him. Or not necessarily inspiration, but just like it's reflected in a lot of his works. Images of tragedy with women and images of like disease and not, I say images, but I mean wordplay about disease and tragedy with women. And this is all a result of his history with his wife and his mother, and it's all reflected in his art. But while she's sick, he still needs to keep working, you know. Even though she's becoming sicker and sicker, life doesn't stop, and he starts really trying to hustle at this time, because, you know, the hustle was real before, and then she gets diagnosed with this, and the hustle becomes even more real. So they move to New York, where Poe, having a list of decent credentials as a critic, a writer, an editor, a published author, he's now able to get a job at the Brooklyn Journal. And later, he would actually become the owner of the Brooklyn Journal. But all the while, he is kind of like entrenched in this madness of reminiscing about his past and all the death in his past and the current situation that's going on with his wife. And he starts to drink more, and he starts to isolate himself from his community of writers. And he begins to start accusing other writers of plagiarizing his work, and he distances himself from other people in his profession. And it's right around this time in 1845 that he publishes his most famous poem, The Raven. It's published in a magazine called The Evening Mirror, and it was a hit. It was a sensation. He was paid $9 for the publication, and after its initial publication, it would go on to be published in a slew of other magazines and journals. And now he's kind of experiencing this celebrity-ish style of notoriety for a little bit of time, but less than 2 years after the poem is published, his wife dies in 1847. And after she dies, he kind of like descends into an even deeper state of madness. But he also is like diving deeper into work as well. He starts drinking heavily, and he starts drinking even more heavily and isolating himself even more heavily. But he's also still publishing, editing, doing critiques, and just like keeping the wheels turning. He kind of like buries himself in the work as well. And it's not long after this that he dies. And there's a lot of mystery surrounding his death. Less than 2 years after his wife dies, he is found in Baltimore, delirious, and in need of very obvious medical attention. He was taken to Washington State Medical College and died 4 days later. And he wasn't really like conscious and coherent long enough to explain what had happened to him. He was also wearing clothes that weren't his. They didn't fit right, and they obviously were like not something tailored for him. And as he spent those last few days at the medical college, he was said to have repeatedly yelled out the name Reynolds, which it's never really become clear who Reynolds was. His attending physician said that Poe's final words were, "Lord, help my poor soul." And all of his death records, including his death certificate, have been lost. At the time, newspapers reported his death as a cause of cerebral inflammation, which was a polite way of saying someone had died due to disreputable causes, such as alcoholism. There are a lot of theories about the way Poe actually died. Delirium tremors, heart disease, epilepsy, syphilis, cholera, carbon monoxide poisoning, and rabies. But one theory is that Poe was a victim of cooping. And I'll kind of break it down a little bit. The theory of cooping is that, like, maybe a political group says if you keep going in somewhere and voting for a candidate, like over and over at different polling places, wearing different clothes, and acting like a different person, we will keep giving you drinks. And the theory is that Poe did this. He would change his clothes. He got, like, you know, taken or captured, abducted, what have you, and by this group of people who, you know, gave him this proposition. And the theory is that Poe did this. He was changing his clothes, he was wearing wigs, or he was doing whatever it took to keep the drinks coming. And maybe after they were done with him, after he had voted enough for them and they had given him enough drinks, he just kind of became, like, belligerent, and they kind of bashed him on the head and threw him to the curb and or beat him up, you know, who knows. But I think of all the theories, that cooping is probably the most probable. Either way, he had a very tragic life, and he is one of the highest regarded horror writers from his time. He's an icon of horror and a master of the macabre. So let's get into a couple of his works. Let's get into a couple of his stories and poems. The first one I'd like to read to you is called The Fall of the House of Usher. And in The Fall of the House of Usher, the mad Roderick Usher disposes of his twin sister Madeline by entombing her alive in the cellar of their ancestral home. Poe's inspiration for the insane Usher twins may have been two real-life Usher twins, James Campbell Usher and Agnes Pye Usher. They were the two children of Luke Noble Usher, who was an actor that performed with Poe's actress mother. And much as in the story, the real Usher twins are believed to have gone insane. The Fall of the House of Usher, Part 1. It was a dark and soundless day, near the end of the year, and clouds were hanging low in the heavens. All day, I had been riding on horseback through countryside with little life or beauty, and in the early evening, I came within view of the House of Usher. I do not know how it was, but with my first sight of the building, a sense of heavy sadness filled my spirit. I looked at the scene before me, at the house itself, at the ground around it, at the cold stone walls of the building, at its empty eye-like windows, and at a few dead trees. I look at this scene, I say, with a complete sadness of soul, which was no healthy earthly feeling. There was a coldness, a sickness of the heart, in which I could discover nothing to lighten the weight I felt. What was it, I asked myself, what was it that was so fearful or frightening in my view of the House of Usher? This was a question to which I could find no answer. I stopped my horse beside the building on the edge of the dark and quiet lake. There, I could see reflecting in the water a clear picture of the dead trees, and of the house and its empty eye-like windows. I was now going to spend several weeks in this house of sadness, this house of gloom. Its owner was named Roderick Usher. We had been friends when we were boys, but many years had passed since our last meeting. A letter from him had reached me, a wild letter, which demanded that I reply by coming to see him. He wrote of an illness of the body, of sickness of the mind, and of a desire to see me, his best and indeed his only friend. It was the manner in which all of this was said, it was the heart in it, which did not allow me to say no. Although as a boy we'd been together, I really knew little about my friend. I knew, however, that his family, a very old one, had long been famous for its understanding of all the arts and for many quiet acts of kindness to the poor. I had learned, too, that the family had never been a large one, with many branches. The name had passed always from father to son, and when people spoke of the House of Usher, they included both the family and the family home. I again looked up from the picture of the house reflecting in the lake to the house itself. A strange idea grew in my mind, an idea so strange that I tell it only to show the force of the feeling which laid their weight on me. I really believe that around the whole house and the ground around it, the air itself was different. It was not the air of heaven. It rose from the dead, decaying trees, from the gray walls and the quiet lake. It was a sickly, unhealthy air that I could see, slow moving, heavy and gray. Shaking off from my spirit what must have been a dream, I looked more carefully at the building itself. The most noticeable thing about it seemed to be its great age. None of the walls had fallen, yet the stones appeared to be in a condition of advanced decay. Perhaps the careful eye would have discovered the beginning of a break in the front of the building, a crack making its way from the top down to the wall until it became lost in the dark waters of the lake. I rode over a short bridge to the house. A man who worked in the house, a servant, took my horse and entered. Another servant, of quiet step, led me without a word through many dark turnings to the room of his master. Much that I met on the way added, I do not know how, to the strangeness of which I have already spoken. While the objects around me, the dark wall coverings, the blackness of the floors, and the things brought home from long-forgotten wars, while these things were like the things I had known since I was a baby, while I admitted that all this was only what I had expected, I was still surprised at the strange ideas which grew in my mind from these simple things. The room I came into was very large and high. The windows were high and pointed at the top, and so far above the black floor that they were quite out of reach. Only a little light, red in color, made its way through the glass and served to lighten the nearer and larger objects. My eyes, however, tried and failed to see into the far high corners of the dark room. Dark coverings hung upon the walls. The many chairs and tables had been used for a long, long time. Books now lay around the room, but could give no sense of life. I felt sadness hanging over everything. No escape from this deep, cold gloom seemed possible. As I entered the room, Usher stood up from where he had been lying and met me with a warmth, which at first I could not believe was real. A look, however, at his face told me that every word he spoke was true. We sat down, and for some moments, while he said nothing, I looked at him with a feeling of sad surprise. Surely no man had ever before changed as Redrick Usher had. Could this be the friend of my early years? It is true that his face had always been unusual. He had gray-white skin, eyes large and full of light, lips not bright in color, but of a beautiful shape, a well-shaped nose, hair of great softness, a face that was not easy to forget. And now the increase in this strangeness of his face had caused so great a change that I almost did not know him. The horrible white of his skin and the strange light in his eyes surprised me and even made me afraid. His hair had been allowed to grow, and in its softness it did not fall around his face, but seemed to lie upon the air. I could not, even with an effort, see in my friend the appearance of a simple human being. In this manner, I saw at once. Changes came and went, and I soon found that this resulted from his attempt to quiet a very great nervousness. I had indeed been prepared for something like this, partly by his letter and partly by remembering him as a boy. His actions were first too quick and then too quiet. Sometimes his voice, slow and trembling with fear, quickly changed to strong, heavy, carefully paced, too perfectly controlled manner. It was in this manner that he spoke of the purpose of my visit, of his desire to see me, and of the deep delight and strength he expected me to give him. He told me what he believed to be the nature of his illness. It was, he said, a family sickness, and one from which he could not hope to grow better. But it was, he added at once, only a nervous illness, which would without doubt soon pass away. It showed itself in a number of strange feelings. Some of this, as he told me of them, interested me, but were beyond my understanding. Perhaps the way in which he told me of them added to this strangeness. He suffered much from a sickly increase in the feeling of all the senses. He could eat only the most tasteless food. All flowers smelled too strongly for his nose. His eyes were hurt by even a little light, and there were few sounds which did not fill him with horror. A certain kind of sick fear was completely his master. "I shall die," he said. "I shall die. I must die of the fool's sickness. In this way, and no other way, I shall be lost. I fear what will happen in the future. Not for what happens, but for the result of what happens. I have indeed no fear of pain, but only fear of its result, of terror. I feel that the time will soon arrive when I must lose my life and my mind and my soul together in some last battle with that horrible enemy, fear." Part 2. Redrick Usher, whom I had known as a boy, was now ill and had asked me to come help him. When I arrived, I felt something strange and fearful about the great old stone house, about the lake in front of it, and about Usher himself. He appeared not like a human being, but like a spirit that had come back from beyond the grave. It was an illness, he said, from which he would surely die. He called his sickness fear. "I have," he said, "no fear of pain, but only the fear of its result, of terror. I feel that the time will soon arrive when I must lose my life and my mind and my soul together in some last battle with the horrible enemy, fear. I learned also, but slowly and through broken words with doubtful meaning, another strange fact about the condition of Usher's mind. He had certain sick fears about the house in which he lived, and he had not stepped out of it for many years. He felt that the house, with its gray walls and the quiet lake around it, had somehow, through the long years, gotten a strong hold on his spirit. He said, however, that much of the gloom which lay so heavily on him was probably caused by something more plainly to see, by the long continued illness, indeed, the coming death, of a dearly loved sister, his only company for many years, except for himself. She was the last member of his family on earth. "When she dies," he said, with a sadness which I can never forget, "when she dies, I will be the last of the old, old family, the house of Usher." While he spoke, the Lady Madeline, for so she was called, passed slowly through the distant part of the room, and without seeing that I was there, went on. I looked at her with a complete and wondering surprise, and with some fear, and yet I found I could not explain to myself such feelings. My eyes followed her. When she came to a door, and it closed behind her, my eyes turned to the face of her brother. But he had put his face in his hands, and I could see only that the thin fingers through which his tears were flowing were whiter than ever before. The illness of the Lady Madeline had long been beyond the help of her doctors. She seemed to care about nothing. Slowly, her body had grown thin and weak, and often for a short period, she would fall into a sleep like the sleep of the dead. So far, she had not been forced to stay in bed, but by the evening of the day I arrived at the house, the power of her destroyer, as her brother told me that night, was too strong for her. I learned that my one sight of her would probably be the last I would have, that the lady, at least while living, would be seen by me no more. For several days following, her name was not spoken by either Usher or myself, And during this period, I was busy with efforts to lift my friend out of his sadness and gloom. We painted and read together, or listened, as if in a dream, to the wild music he played. And so, as a warmer and more loving friendship grew between us, I saw more clearly the uselessness of all attempts to bring happiness to a mind from which only darkness came, spreading upon all objects in the world its never-ending gloom. I shall always remember the hours I spent with the master of the House of Usher. Yet I would fail in any attempt to give an idea of the true character of the things we did together. There was a strange light over everything. The paintings which he made me tremble, though I know not why. To tell of them is beyond the power of written words. If ever a man painted an idea, that man was Redrick Usher. For me, at least, there came out of his pictures a sense of fear and wonder. One of these pictures may be told, although weakly in words. It showed the inside of a room where the dead might be placed, with low walls, white and plain. It seemed to be very deep under the earth. There was no door, no window, no light, no fire burned, yet a river of light flowed through it, filling it with a horrible, ghastly brightness. I have spoken of that sickly condition of the senses which made most music painful for Usher to hear. The notes he could listen to with pleasure were very few. It was this fact, perhaps, that made the music he played so different from most music. But the wild beauty of his playing could not be explained. The words of one of his songs called The Haunted Palace I have easily remembered. In it, I thought I saw, and for the first time, that Usher knew very well that his mind was weakening. This song told of a great house where a king lived, a palace, in a green valley where all was light and color and beauty, and the air was sweet. In the palace were two bright windows through which people in that happy valley could hear music and could see smiling ghosts, spirits, moving around the king. The palace door was of the richest materials, in red and white. Through it came other spirits whose only duty was to sing in their beautiful voices about how wise their king was. But a dark change came from the song continued, and now those who enter the valley see through the windows, in a red light, shapes that move to broken music, while through the door, now colorless, a ghastly river of ghosts, laughing, but no longer smiling, rushes out forever. Our talks of song led to another strange idea in Usher's mind. He believed that plants could feel and think, and not only plants, but rocks and water as well. He believed that the gray stones of his house and the small plants growing in the stones and the decaying trees had a power over him that made him what he was. Our books, the books which, for years, had fed the sick man's mind, were, as might be supposed, of this same wild character. Some of these books Usher sat and studied for hours. His chief delight was found in reading one very old book, written for some forgotten church, telling of the watch over the dead. At last, one evening, he told me that the Lady Madeline was alive no more. He said he was going to keep her body for a time in one of the many vaults inside the walls of the building. The worldly reason he gave for this was one with which I felt I had to agree. He had to decide to do this because of the nature of her illness, because of the strange interest and questions of her doctors, and because of the great distance to the graveyard where members of his family were placed in the earth. We too carried her body to its resting place. The vault in which he placed it was small and dark, and in ages past, it must have seen strange and bloody scenes. It lay deep below the part of the building where I myself slept. The thick door was iron, and because of its great weight, made a loud, hard sound when it was opened and closed. As we placed the Lady Madeline in this room of horror, I saw for the first time the great likeness between brother and sister, and Usher told me then that they were twins. They had been born on the same day. For that reason, the understanding between them had always been great, and the tie that held them together very strong. We looked down at the dead face one last time, and I was filled with wonder as she lay there. The Lady Madeline looked not dead, but asleep, still soft and warm, though at the touch cold as the stones around us. Part 3. I was visiting an old friend of mine, Redrick Usher, in his old stone house, his palace, where a feeling of death hung on the air. I saw how fear was pressing on his heart and mind. Now, his only sister, the Lady Madeline, had died, and we had put her body in its resting place, in a room inside the cold walls of the palace, a damp, dark vault, a fearful place. As we looked down upon her face, I saw that there was a strong likeness between the two. Indeed, said Usher, we were born on the same day, and the tie between us has always been strong. We did not look down at her, for fear and wonder filled our hearts. There was still a little color in her face, and there seemed to be a smile on her lips. We closed the heavy iron door and returned to the rooms above, which were hardly less gloomy than the vault. And now a change came in the sickness of my friend's mind. He went from room to room with a hurried step. His face was, if possible, whiter and more ghastly than before, and the light in his eyes had gone. The trembling in his voice seemed to show the greatest fear. At times, he sat looking at nothing for hours, as if listening to some sound I could not hear. I felt his condition slowly but certainly gaining power over me. I felt that his wild ideas were becoming fixed in my own mind. As I was going to bed late in the night of the 7th or 8th day after we placed the Lady Madeline within the vault, I experienced the full power of such feelings. Sleep did not come while the hours passed. My mind fought against the nervousness. I tried to believe that much, if not all, of what I felt was due to the gloomy room, to the dark wall coverings, which in a rising wind moved the walls. But my efforts were useless. A trembling I could not stop filled my body, and fear without reason caught my heart. I sat up, looking into the darkness of my room, listening. I do not know why, to certain low sounds which came when the storm was quiet. A feeling of horror lay upon me like a heavy weight. I put on my clothes and began walking nervously around the room. I had been walking for a very short time when I heard a light step coming toward the door. I knew it was Usher. In a moment, I saw him at my door, as usual, very white. There was a wild laugh in his eyes. Even so, I was glad to have his company. "And have you not seen it?" he said. He hurried to one of the windows and opened it to the storm. The force of the entering wind nearly lifted us from our feet. It was, indeed, a stormy but beautiful night, and wildly strange. The heavy, low-hanging clouds which seemed to press down upon the house flew from all directions against each other, always returning and never passing away in the distance. With their great thickness, they cut off all light from the moon and the stars. But we could see them because they were lighted from below, by the air itself, which we could see, rising from the dark lake and from the stones of the house itself. "You must not, you shall not look at this," I said to Usher, and I led him from the window to a seat. "This appearance, which surprises you so, has been seen in other places, too. Perhaps the lake is the cause. Let us close the window. The air is cold." "Here is one of the stories you like best. I will read, and you shall listen, and thus we will live through this fearful night together." The old book which I had picked up was one written by a fool for fools to read. And it was not, in truth, one that Usher liked. It was, however, the only one within easy reach. He seemed to listen quietly. Then I came to a part of the story in which a man, a strong man, full of wine, begins to break down a door, and the sound of the dry wood as it breaks can be heard through all the forest around him. Here I stopped, for it seemed to me that for some very distant part of the house sounds came to my ears, like those which I had been reading. It must have been this likeness that had made me notice them, for the sounds themselves, with the storm, this increasing, were nothing to stop or interest me. I continued the story, and read how the man, now entering through the broken door, discovers a strange and terrible animal of the kind so often found in these old stories. He strikes it, and it falls with such a cry that he has to close his ears with his hands. Here again, I stopped. There could be no doubt. This time, I did hear a distant sound, very much like the cry of the animal in the story. I tried to control myself so that my friend would see nothing of what I felt. I was not certain that he had heard the sound, although he had clearly changed in some way. He had slowly moved his chair, so I could not see him well. I did see that his lips were moving as he were speaking to himself. His head had dropped forward, but I knew he was not asleep. His eyes were open, and he was moving his body from side to side. I began reading again and quickly came to the part of the story where a heavy piece of iron falls on the floor with a ringing sound. These words had just passed my lips when I heard clearly, but from far away, a loud ringing sound, as if something of iron had indeed fallen upon a stone floor, or as if an iron door had closed. I lost control of myself completely and jumped up from my chair. Usher still sat, moving a little from side to side. His eyes were turned to the floor. I rushed to his chair. As I placed my hand on his shoulder, I felt his whole body was trembling. A sickly smile touched his lips. He spoke in a low, quick, and nervous voice, as if he did not know I was there. "Yes," he said, "I heard it. Many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it. But I did not dare to speak. We have put her living in the vault. Did I not say that my senses were too strong? I heard her first movements many days ago, but I did not dare to speak. And now that story. But the sounds were hers. Oh, where shall I run? She is coming. Coming to ask why I put her there so soon. I hear her footsteps on the stairs. I hear the heavy beating of her heart." Here, he jumped up and cried as if he were giving up his soul. "I tell you, she now stands at the door." The great door to which he was pointing now slowly opened. It was the work of the rushing wind, perhaps, but no. Outside that door, a shape did stand. The tall figure, in its grave clothes, of the Lady Madeline of Usher. There was blood upon her white dress, and the signs of her terrible efforts to escape were upon every part of her thin form. For a moment she remained trembling at the door. Then, with a low cry, she fell heavily upon her brother. In her pain, as she died at last, she carried him down with her, down to the floor. He too was dead, killed by his own fear. I rushed from the room. I rushed from the house. I ran. The storm was all around me in all of its strength as I crossed the bridge. Suddenly, a wild light moved around the ground at my feet, and I turned to see where it could have come from, for only the great house and its darkness were behind me. The light was from the full moon, of a blood-red moon, which was now shining through the break in the front wall. That crack which I thought I had seen when I first saw the place. Then, only a little crack. It now widened as I watched. A strong wind came rushing over me. The whole face of the moon appeared. I saw the great walls falling apart. There was a long and stormy shouting sound, and the deep black lake closed darkly over all that remained of the House of Usher. The end. Dark, ethereal, atmospheric, macabre, beautiful, he has a way of spinning a very just like beautiful story of terror. And it's like, it's got this language, it's got this like romantic flowery language where even though it's not a poem, it's kind of like written in this way that is very much like a poem. The cadence of how things are described and how things unfold and even the dialogue are very, very intentional. Just a beautifully terrifying story. I love it. Hey, yo, so this is like the middle of the show, and I wanted to, first of all, thank everyone for dialing into this podcast. I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you are sharing this experience with me. If you'd like to support the podcast, leaving a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening to this on goes a really, really long way. Also, if you are able to leave a review for the podcast, that also goes an extremely long way. Another way you can support the podcast, other than just telling your friends and family about it, is signing up on my Patreon. There is a link in the description of this episode and all the episodes, or you can just go to patreon.com and search for Mount Analog, MT period ANALOGUE. You get early access to podcasts, early access to my music, early access to art, and all kinds of other cool stuff. However you support, I cannot thank you enough. Infinite, infinite, infinite thank yous. I love you. Infinite blessings to you. Let's get back to the podcast. The next story I want to read is called Berenice, and it's Poe's first horror story. I don't want to say too much or give too much away, but this one, like most of his stories, is inspired by actual events. Poe was living in Baltimore in February 1833, and the Baltimore Saturday Visitor reported that grave robbers had been caught stealing the teeth of corpses for dentures, which is like super gnarly and gross. But 2 years later, Poe publishes Berenice, and he's quoted as saying, "This story originated in a bet that I could produce nothing effective on a subject so singular, provided I treated it seriously." So without further ado, Berenice. Misery is manifold. The wretchedness of earth is multiform. Overreaching the wide horizon as the rainbow, its hues are as various as the hues of that arch. As distant, too, yet as intimately blended. Overreaching the wide horizon as the rainbow. How is it that from beauty I have derived a type of unloveliness? From the covenant of peace, a smile of sorrow? But as, in ethics, evil is a consequence of good, so in fact, out of joy is sorrow born. Either the memory of past bliss is the anguish of today, or the agonies which have their origins in the ecstasies which might have been. My baptismal name is Aegeus, that of a family I will not mention, yet there are no towers in the land more time-honored than my gloomy, gray, hereditary halls. Our line has been called a race of visionaries, and, in many striking particulars, in the character of the family mansion, in the frescoes of the chief saloon, in the tapestries of the dormitories, in the chiseling of some buttresses in the armory, but more especially in the gallery of antique paintings, in the fashion of the library chamber, and lastly, in the very peculiar nature of the library's content, there is more than sufficient evidence to warrant the belief. The recollections of my earliest years are connected with that chamber, and with its volumes, of which latter I will say no more. Here died my mother. Herein was I born. But it is mere idleness to say that I had not lived before, that the soul has no previous existence. You deny it? Let us not argue the matter. Convinced myself, I seek not to convince. There is, however, a remembrance of aerial forms, of spiritual and meaning eyes, of sounds, musical yet sad, a remembrance which will not be excluded. A memory like a shadow, vague, variable, indefinite, unsteady, and like a shadow, too, in the impossibility of my getting rid of it while the sunlight of my reason shall exist. In that chamber was I born, thus awakening from the long night of what seemed, but was not, non-entity. At once into the very regions of fairyland, into a place of imagination, into the wild dominions of monastic thought and erudition, it is not singular that I gazed around me with a startled and ardent eye, that I loitered away my boyhood in books and misplaced my youth in reverie. But it is singular that as years rolled away and the noon of manhood found me still in the mansion of my fathers, it is wonderful what stagnation there fell upon the springs of my life. Wonderful how total an inversion took place in the character of my commonest thought. The realities of the world affected me as visions, and as visions only, while the wild ideas of the land and dreams became, in truth, not the material of my everyday existence, but in very deed, that existence utterly and solely in itself. Berenice and I were cousins, and we grew up together in my paternal halls. Yet differently we grew, I, ill of health, and buried in gloom, she, agile, graceful, and overflowing with energy, hers the ramble on the hillside, mine the studies of the cloister. I, living within my own heart, and addicted body and soul to the most intense and painful meditation, she, roaming carelessly through life with no thought of the shadows in her path or the silent flight of the raven-winged hours. Berenice. I call upon her name, Berenice. And from the gray ruins of memory, a thousand tumultuous recollections are settled at the sound. Ah, vividly is her image before me now, as in the early days of her light-heartedness and joy. Oh, gorgeous, yet fantastic beauty. Oh, sylph amid the shrubberies of Arnheim. Oh, naiad among its fountains. And then, all in mystery and terror, a tale which should not be told. Disease. A fatal disease fell like the simoom upon her frame. And even while I gazed upon her, the spirit of her change swept over her, pervading her mind, her habits, and her character, and in a manner the most subtle and terrible, disturbing even the identity of her person. Alas, the destroyer came and went, and the victim, where was she? I knew her not. Or knew her no longer as Berenice. Among the numerous train of maladies, superinduced by the fatal and primary one, which effected a revolution of so horrible a kind in the moral and physical being of my cousin, may be mentioned as the most distressing and obstinate in its nature, a species of epilepsy not unfrequently terminating in trance itself. Trance very nearly resembling positive disillusion, and from which her manner of recovery was in most instances startlingly abrupt. In the meantime, my own disease, for I have been told that I should call it by no other appellation, my own disease then grew rapidly upon me, and assumed finally a monomaniac character of a novel and extraordinary form, hourly and momently, gaining vigor, and all length obtaining over me the most incomprehensible ascendancy. This monomania, if I must so term it, consisted in a morbid irritability of those prosperities of the mind, in metaphysical science termed the attentive. It is more than probable that I am not understood, but I fear, indeed, that it is no manner possible to convey to the mind of the merely general reader an adequate idea of the nervous intensity of interest with which, in my case, the powers of meditation, not to speak technically, busied and buried themselves in the contemplation of even the most ordinary objects of the universe. To muse for long, unwearied hours with my attention riveted to some frivolous device on the margin or in the topography of a book. To become absorbed for the better part of a summer's day in a quaint shadow falling aslant upon the tapestry. Or upon the door, to lose myself for an entire night in watching the steady flame of the lamp or in the embers of a fire, to dream away whole days over the perfume of a flower, to repeat monotonously some common word until the sound, by dint or frequent repetition cease to convey any idea whatever to the mind, to lose all sense of motion or physical existence, by means of absolute bodily quietness long and obstinately preserved in. Such were a few of the most common and least pernicious vagaries induced by a condition of the mental faculties. Not, indeed, altogether unparalleled, but certainly bidding defiance to anything like analysis or explanation. Yet let me not be misapprehended. The undue, earnest, and morbid attention thus excited by objects in their own nature, frivolous, must not be confounded in character with the ruminating prosperity common to all mankind, and more especially indulgent in by persons of ardent imagination. It was not even, as might be at first supposed, an extreme condition or exaggeration of some propensity, but primarily and essentially distinct and different. In the one instance, the dreamer or enthusiast being interested by an object usually not frivolous imperceptibly loses sight of this object in a wilderness of deductions and suggestions issued therefrom, until at the conclusion of the daydream, often replete with luxury, he finds the incitamentum or first cause of his musings entirely vanished and forgotten. In my case, the primary object was invariably frivolous, although assuming through the medium of my distempered vision a fractured and unreal importance. Few deductions, if any, were made, and those few pertinaciously returned in upon the original object as a center. The meditations were never pleasurable, and at the termination of the reverie, the first cause, so far from being out of sight, had attained that supernaturally exaggerated interest, which was the prevailing feature of the disease. In a word, the powers of mind more particularly exercised were with me. As I have said before, the attentive and are, with the daydreamer, the speculative. My books at this epoch, if they did not actually serve to irritate the disorder, partook. It will be perceived largely in their imaginative and inconsequential nature of the characteristic qualities of the disorder itself. I will remember, among others, the treatise of the noble Italian Cullius Secundus Curo, De Amplitudine Berte Regne Die, St. Augustine's work, The City of God, and Tertullian, De Carne Christi, in which the paradoxical sentence, Mortis est de felius, credible est de qual ineptum, occupied my undivided time for many weeks of laborious and fruitless investigation. Thus it will appear that, shaken from this balance only by trivial things, my reason bore resemblance to that ocean crag of by Ptolemy Hephaestion, which, steadily resisting the attacks of human violence and the fiercer fury of the waters and the winds, trembled only to the touch of the flower called Asphodel. And although to a careless thinker it might appear a matter beyond doubt that the alteration produced by her unhappy malady in the moral condition of Berenice would afford me many objects for the exercise of that intense and abnormal meditation, whose nature I have been at some trouble in explaining, yet such was not in any degree the case. In the lucid intervals of my infirmary, her calamity indeed gave me pain, and taking deeper to heart that total wreck of her fair and gentle life, I did not fall to ponder frequently and bitterly upon the wonder-working means by which so strange a revolution had been so suddenly brought to pass. But these reflections partook not of the idiosyncrasy of my disease, and were such as would have occurred under the similar circumstances to the ordinary mass of mankind. True to its own character, my disorder reveled in the less important but more startling changes wrought in the physical frame of Berenice, in the singular and most appalling distortion of her personal identity. During the brightest days of her unparalleled beauty, most surely I had never loved her. In the strange anomaly of my existence, feelings with me had never been of the heart, and my passions always were of the mind. Through the gray of the early morning, among the trellised shadows of the forest at noonday, and in the silence of my library at night, She had lifted my eyes, and I had seen her, not as the living and breathing Berenice, but as the Berenice of a dream. Not as a being of the earth, earthly, as the abstraction of such a being not, as a thing to admire, but to analyze, not as an object to love, but as the theme of the most abstruse, although delusatory, speculation. And now? Now? I shuddered in her presence and grew pale at her approach. Yet bitterly lamenting her fallen and desolate condition, I called to mind that she had loved me long, and, in an evil moment, I spoke to her of marriage. And at length the period of our nuptials was approaching, when, upon one afternoon, in the winter of the year, one of those unreasonably warm, calm, and misty days, which are the nurse of the beautiful Halcyon, I sat, and sat, as I thought, alone, in the inner apartment of the library. By uplifting my eyes, I saw that Berenice stood before me. Was it my own excited imagination, or the misty influence of the atmosphere, or the uncertain twilight of the chamber, or the gray draperies which fell around the figure, that caused in it so vacillating and indistinct an outline? I could not tell. She spoke no word, not for the worlds. Could I have uttered a syllable? An icy chill ran through my frame. A sense of insufferable anxiety oppressed me. A consuming curiosity pervaded my soul, and sinking back upon the chair, I remained for some time breathless and motionless, with my eyes riveted upon her person. Alas, its emaciation was excessive, and not one vestige of the former being lurked in any single line of the contour. My burning glances at length fell upon the face. The forehead was high, and very pale, and singularly placid, and the once jetty hair fell partially over it, and overshadowed the hollow temples with innumerable ringlets, now of a vivid yellow, and jarring discordantly in their fantastic character with the reigning melancholy of the countenance. The eyes were lifeless and lusterless, and seemingly pupilless, and I shrank involuntarily from their glassy stare to the contemplation of the thin and shrunken lips. They parted, and in a smile of particular meaning, the teeth of the changed Berenice disclosed themselves slowly to my view. Would to God that I had never beheld them, or that, having done so, I had died. For as Jove, during the winter season, gives twice 7 days of warmth, men have called this clement and temperature time. Time, the nurse of the beautiful Halcyon, for the shutting of a door disrupted me, and looking up, I found that my cousin had departed from the chamber, but from the disordered chamber of my brain had not, alas, departed and would not be driven away. The white and ghastly spectrum of the teeth, not a speck of their surface, not a shade on their enamel, not an indenture in their edges. But what that period of her smile had sufficed to brand in upon my memory, I saw them now, even more unequivocally than I beheld them then. The teeth, they were here, and there, and everywhere, and visibly and palpably before me. Long, narrow, and excessively white, with the pale lips writhing about them, as in the very moment of their first terrible development. Then came the full fury of my monomania. I struggled in vain against its strange and irresistible influence. In the multiplied objects of the external world, I had no thoughts but for the teeth. For these, I longed with a frenzied desire. All other matters and all different interests became absorbed in their single contemplation. They alone were present to the mental eye, and they, in their sole individuality, became the essence of my mental life. I held them in every light. I turned them in every attitude. I surveyed their characteristics. I dwelt upon their particularities. I pondered upon their conformation. I mused upon the alteration in their nature. I shuddered as I assigned to them, in imagination and sensitive and sentient power, and even while unassisted by the lips, a capability of moral expression. And of Bernice I more seriously believed, "Oh, Mademoiselle Celle, it has been well said, que toi ces dents Etiente des Aedes. I just want to interject here and say that des Aedes translates from French to English as body of thought. Back to the story. Ah, here was the idiotic thought that destroyed me. Des Aedes. Ah, therefore, it was that I coveted them so madly. I felt that their possession could only ever restore me to peace in giving me back to reason. And the evening closed in upon me thus. And then the darkness came and tarried and went, and the day again dawned, and the mists of a second night were now gathering around. And still I sat motionless in that solitary room, and still I sat buried in meditation, and still the phantasm of the teeth maintained its terrible ascendancy as, with the most vivid, hideous distinctness, it floated about amid the changing lights and shadows of the chamber. At length, there broke in upon my dreams a cry as of horror and dismay, and thereunto, after a pause, succeeded the sound of troubled voices, intermingled with many low moanings of sorrow or pain. I arose from my seat, and throwing open one of the doors of the library, saw standing out in the antechamber a servant maiden, all in tears, who told me that Berenice was no more. She had been seized by epilepsy in the early morning, and now, at the closing in of the night, the grave was ready for its tenant, and all the preparations for the burial were completed. I found myself sitting in the library, and again sitting there alone. It seemed that I had newly awakened from a confused and exciting dream. I knew that it was now midday, and I was well aware that since the setting of the sun, Berenice had been interred. But of that dreary period which intervened, I had no positive, at least no definite, comprehension. Yet its memory was replete with horror. Horror more horrible from being vague, and terror more terrible from ambiguity. It was a fearful page in the record of my existence, written all over with dim and hideous and unintelligible recollections. I strive to decipher them, but in vain. While ever and anon, like the spirit of a departed sound, the shrill and piercing shriek of a female voice seemed to be ringing in my ears. I had done a deed. What was it? I asked myself the question aloud, and the whispering echoes of the chamber answered me. What was it? On the table beside me burned a lamp, and near it lay a little box. It was of no remarkable character, and I had seen it frequently before, for it was the property of the family physician. But how came it there, upon my table, and why did I shudder in regarding it? These things were in no manner to be accounted for, and my eyes at length dropped to the open pages of the book, and to a sentence underscored therein. The words were the singular but simple ones of the poet Ibn Zayd. Why then, as I pursued them, did the hairs on my head erect themselves on end, and the blood of my body become congealed within my veins? There came a light tap at the library door, and pale as the tenant of a tomb, a menial entered upon tiptoe. His looks were wild with terror, and he spoke in a voice tremulous, husky, and very low. What said he? Some broken sentence, I heard. He told of a wild cry disturbing the silence of the night, of the gathering together of the household, of a search in the direction of the sound. And then his tones grew thrillingly distant as he whispered me of a violated grave and of a disfigured body enshrouded, yet still breathing, still palpitating, still alive. He pointed to garments. They were muddy and clotted with gore. I spoke not, and he took me gently by the hand. It was indeed with the impress of human nails. He directed my attention to some object against the wall. I looked at it for some minutes. It was a spade. With a shriek, I bounded to the table and grasped the box and lay upon it. But I could not force it open, and in my tremor it spilled from my hands and fell heavily and burst into pieces. And from it, with a rattling sound, there rolled out some instruments of dental surgery. Intermingled with the 32 small white and ivory-looking substances that were scattered to and fro about the floor. The end. This one was laborious. Lots of flowery language, lots of very intricate wordplay. I feel like you get the gist of the story. Poe goes into all of the detail on the madness as he does in all of his stories. Like, I feel like the primary focus of so many of his stories is describing the madness that overtakes you, or the madness that overtakes his characters and his stories. There are a lot of like old words in here, and a lot of just a lot of language that we don't really use today. A lot of difficult words, a lot of laborious words, a lot of ostentatious words. Just a lot of that's kind of how authors did back then. So if you stuck with me through that entire story, thank you for hanging in there with me. We're going to do just one more, and this one is his most famous poem. I'm going to read The Raven. Even if you're not into poetry or into Edgar Allan Poe, you've at least heard of this poem, and you've probably heard it before. And if you haven't heard it, sit back and let the chilling madness sink in. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. "Only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entering entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entering entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is, I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door, darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into the darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was broken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping, something louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely, this is nothing at my window lattice. Let me see, then, what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore, "Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou," I said, "art sure no craven? Ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevance bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door. Bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only the one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further then he uttered, not a feather, then a flutter, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken, by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock and store. Caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope and melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my sad soul into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking that this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant, and croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing, to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my heart and ease reclining, on the cushion's velvet lining, that the lamp light gloated, o'er, but whose velvet violet lining, with the lamp lit, gloating, o'er, she shall pass, ah, nevermore. Then, methought, the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and neopinth from the memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh quaff, this kind nepenthe, and forgot this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether trumpeter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends upon us, by the God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting. Bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of the lie thou hast spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamp-lit o'er, him streaming, throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul, from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. Classic, classy Edgar Allan Poe. And this one was another example of his characters embodying that ascension into madness. That's what he was best at, like letting you know how crazy these characters were getting, how uneased and nervous and anxious these characters were getting. A lot of his stories follow this format of going down this spiral, like starting in a really gloomy place, but then like turning into this obsessive spiral. And in this one, it's obviously with the Raven. He's reminiscing of his lost Lenore, and the Raven is taunting him and won't leave his chamber, and is just saying, basically, she's not coming back. And he's like, won't you leave me? And he's like, nope, I'm staying, and I'm going to drive you crazy. That one was published back in 1845, so very long time ago, but is considered one of the greatest poems of his time and of our time, and just in the horror genre. I'm sure you've heard it. I'm sure you've seen it parodied in things. I'm sure it's on like bumper stickers and stuff, you know. But I figured I'd read it here today on the podcast just in case you haven't heard it. Now you have. And with that, I'm going to get onto the segment of the podcast I like to call Let's Ask AI.
Let's Ask AI.
So I wanted to see if AI could write a poem in the style of Edgar Allan Poe, just because I thought that was like interesting. Like, you've heard me read The House of Usher, you've heard me read Berenice, and you've heard me read The Raven. I feel like right now, if you've been listening, you have a full scope of what these stories feel like. These Edgar Allan Poe, the Edgar Allan Poe vibe. You've been sitting and marinating in it for the last like hour and 40 minutes. So let's see how AI's, and I haven't read this yet, so this is a first read for me too. Let's see how AI's Edgar Allan Poe style poem sounds. I just said, my whole prompt was, can you write me an Edgar Allan Poe style poem? And this is what AI wrote. The night was dark and stormy. The wind was howling loud, and the rain was beating on the roof. Loud, 1,000 drums in a crowd. I sat alone in my chamber, reading by the fire, when I heard a noise outside, like the scratching of a wire. I went to the window and looked out into the night, but I could see nothing except the swirling snow and sleet. I went back to my chair and tried to forget the noise, but it kept coming back, like a bad dream that won't go away. Finally, I could stand it no longer. I got up and went to the door and opened it a crack. Outside, I saw a figure standing in the shadows. It was a tall, thin figure with long white hair and a pale face. The figure looked at me, and its eyes were like two burning coals. I screamed and slammed the door and locked it tight. I sat down in my chair and tried to calm down, but I couldn't stop thinking about the figure in the shadows. I knew that I would never forget the night I saw the thing. The thing that haunts my dreams. So definitely not as poetic. Definitely not as... definitely doesn't have as much juice. Definitely doesn't have as much emotion and electricity as the poems of Edgar Allan Poe. But still there. Still, you know, you did it. You did it, AI. Thanks for giving it your best shot. I really appreciate that. Thank you. And so this brings us close to the end of the podcast. And if you've listened to other episodes, you already know that we get into fun facts at the end of each episode. And for this one, I wanted to keep it on point with the subject of the podcast. I wanted to just talk about five quick, because I don't want to keep you guys too much longer. I wanted to talk about five quick Edgar Allan Poe facts that I haven't mentioned before, that I haven't mentioned already. The first one is that he was the first person to use the term short story. So not only was he writing poems and short stories, he came up with the term short story, which makes sense because he is like the king of horror short stories. He first used the term in a publication in 1840. Our next fun fact is something very fitting of Edgar Allan Poe's life. And that's that in 1863, there was a psychic and kind of like a medium between the spirit world and the physical world. Her name was Lizzie Doughton, L-I-Z-Z-I-E-D-O-T-E-N. And she claimed that she was communicating with Edgar Allan Poe from beyond the grave, and that he was sending her poetry. And she actually wrote these down and had some of them published. So if you get a chance, check out some of Lizzie Doughton's poems that have been published that were communications from Poe from beyond the grave. That book is called Poems from the Inner Life, and it was published in 1863. But I'm not sure if it's in like the public domain, but you can find some of those poems online. I don't know if you can find like the entire book, but it's interesting. This next one is a very simple one that a lot of people probably know, and it's actually about my girlfriend's favorite football team, the Baltimore Ravens. They actually got their name. Their name is inspired by, and it's a celebration of Edgar Allan Poe. So just a fun little tidbit. If you didn't know, now you know. Fact number four is that Poe would often place his Siamese cat on his shoulder when he would start writing a poem. And he sometimes wrote about cats in his works of fiction. One of his other most famous works is The Black Cat, which was published in 1843. But he's got other works, other poems, some short stories that are heavily centered around cats. And could it have been that his Siamese cat was whispering musings into his ear while he was writing? Possibly. And our last fact is that Poe coined the word tintinnabulation to describe the sound made by the ringing of bells. And this word was invented by Poe in his poem, The Bells, where he writes, keeping time, 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 and a sort of runic rhythm to the tintinnabulation that so musically wells from the jingling and tinkling of the bells. I feel like all great writers, poets, literary people were just out there making up words. A lot of people did it. Shakespeare, I think, he's responsible for like making over 1,000 words that are still used today. So, and he's one of the biggest writers and literary people of all time. So I feel like if you're writing stuff and you have a story that has a specific thing happening, you should make up a word for it. You know, like, this is an isolated incident within this universe I created, so I'm going to create a word that is specific for what's going on. Or really just a word that enhances the story I'm trying to tell or the point that I'm trying to make. Pioneers of literature. And with Poe, not only was he a pioneer of creating words, not that he himself created that many words compared to Shakespeare and people like that, but he was a pioneer of this new and emerging genre. Like, horror had been around for a really long time. But in terms of modern horror, he's one of the granddads of it. He's one of the creators of a lot of the tropes that we have today. A lot of the writers that we have today, writers, directors, and just creators in general, wouldn't have the things that they have without Edgar Allan Poe. He was setting up a lot of the base material, a lot of the frameworks, a lot of the initial coding for the rest of the horror genre to play with. And like I said, he wasn't necessarily the first, but he definitely was one of the most prolific and one of the most read. He spearheaded it. He pioneered it. So big ups to Poe for creating such brilliant pieces of work and such beautiful pieces of work. There's like this really weird thing, this really weird blur that happens with really good art, in my opinion, where things can be so beautiful that they're almost scary. And the flip side of that is true in Edgar Allan Poe's case as well. Like, things can be so scary and dark and portrayed with such elegance that they are beautiful. Beauty and terror are delicately intertwined. And I feel like really great art is often indistinguishable from one or the other. A fusion of both darkness, and light. So with that, I think I'm gonna end this podcast. I'm gonna give you your day back. But thank you for being here with me and listening to these epic pieces by one of the most brilliant poets and storytellers to have lived. Once again, that Patreon link is in the description of this episode and in the description of all the episodes. Tell your friends, tell your family, leave those reviews. Maybe consider leaving a star rating on whatever platform you're listening on. However you support, thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Remember to check on your mental health and remember to check on the mental health of your loved ones. Bye.
Analog thoughts.